Welcome this afternoon to session two of a three-part series this week. Let me call up our master image here. And let's see. There we go. Mother Earth, Sister Mother Earth. And we are here to discuss the last half of the Pope's encyclical on care for our common home. And if you speak Italian or Latin, you can pick up on the first part of that, Laudato Si, praise be you, my Lord. Let me first ask, are there those who are here for the first time who were not here yesterday? Great. There are two handouts, should be on the music stand, so feel free to pick each of those up, and because I'll be referring to those from time to time throughout the afternoon. Let's see. I'm wondering about the light. The might be it's a little washed out. And yet we have a challenge here because I'm going to kind of toggle back and forth between the slides and the handout that I know is pretty tiny print and so might be kind of challenging to look at. I would like to begin with a brief review. I think that would be helpful. And as a way to welcome those who are here for the first time this afternoon, but also those who were here yesterday. Now, what did we talk about, and what were some of the highlights? So this is the macro overview, we could say, of our time yesterday, today, and on Thursday. So yesterday we gave an overview of Laudato Si, using the handout, and looked at the questions: why are we trashing our common home? How bad is it? And what can Christian faith perspectives bring to this issue? And those, of course, who were here yesterday, I assigned some homework, namely to look at the chapter two, where the Pope discusses that in more detail, and we will get to that in just a minute. Here we're going to talk about, for me at least, a new concept in reading this document, the Pope's understanding of an integral ecology. And if that word is unfamiliar to me, to you as it was to me, it became helpful for me to think in terms of holistic or a comprehensive sense, comprehensive understanding of this normally environmentally limited term, ecology. And we will get to that a bit later after we've kind of done a fast track through our discussion yesterday. And then tomorrow we are going to pivot somewhat. This encyclical discusses climate change in only 4 out of 246 paragraphs. And so, but they are outsized in importance, I would say, and we want to not only draw on the Pope's understanding of where he stands with the science, but also his broader understanding of how it is that we can respond to the issues in that sphere of the environment, that sphere of caring for our common home. But what does it mean to do so in the spirit of joy, in the spirit of not adding to the fear, the anxiety, even the anger, which so often surrounds these contentious issues. But we will also bring in some other voices on Thursday. And I'll say more about that as we get ready to depart later this afternoon. So, fast track overview. Those of you that, again, are new, might find it helpful to turn to the cover of the four-page document. And what we did yesterday was to spend some time reviewing what the Pope had to say at the very beginning. What's the context, the orientation that the Pope has for adding yet his voice to the hundreds, if not thousands, of books, articles, and documents that have been written about care for our common home in one way or another. It is certainly understandable for us, as well as for people who have not shown any interest in this this letter, this encyclical. What can the Pope, what can this man from Argentina add that is distinctive, that would further our understanding and our commitment to respond in authentic ways? And so here are five highlights. I've just fast-tracked here. He begins the encyclical, as we recall from yesterday, with the imagery from the Canticle of the Creatures by St. Francis nearly 800 years ago. And we actually read and reviewed the entire paragraphs that get us launched, and I won't do that today. But the imagery of the earth as a sister and mother. And I'm going to come back to the question, one I raised yesterday. Ma, doesn't that speak of naive romanticism? Is this really going to be more than just, you know, sitting around a circle and holding hands, kumbaya kind of thing? And so I'll let that question hover for a minute. Next, we lifted up that this is a letter and encyclical to every person living on the planet. So the Pope is reaching out beyond the faithful, beyond Roman Catholics, beyond persons of faith, and so on. He's out to speak to everyone on the planet, but also to do so in a spirit of dialogue. So this is not Father Pope speaking to the children and, you know, wagging his fingers. He genuinely seeks dialogue. And this is something exemplified throughout the document. And we will see it again this afternoon as we turn to the second half of this extraordinary document. One of the first things he does is he's setting the context for his assessment of the issue, how serious it is, what we might begin to do about it. He draws on the wisdom and the statements of earlier popes, as if to, so as not to present his ideas, his thoughts, and convictions as outliers, but rather he documents, I think, in a convincing way that this letter is in step, in sync, with utterances that go back to Pope John the 23rd, actually, some 50 plus years ago. So he's very intentional about that. But now this matter of naive romanticism, isn't the Pope perhaps open to such a charge? And here is where the insert, the single sheet, might come in handy. We took some time to read the underlying portions of paragraph 11. Arguably, that is the paragraph that, if you're a busy person and have only a few minutes here to get your mind around this 246 paragraph document, this is the paragraph that I would suggest that you read and that you offer others who might have heard about it and say, hey, I don't have time to read an 80-page document. Why don't you give me the real skinny here? What is the Pope saying? And I invite those of you who are new to take some time to read the entire paragraph sometime. Okay, one other, well, what you see on the screen is the last bullet is really the essence of that paragraph. Let me read that. He says, to call creatures, no matter how small, by the name brother or sister is not naive romanticism. And now his words, without this openness to awe and wonder, our attitude, the Pope says, will be that of masters, consumers, ruthless exploiters, unable to set limits on their immediate needs. And then if you've got the single sheet before you, the very last line refers to the objectification of nature, which the Pope so strongly resists, speaks out against. Turning nature into a thing, turning nature into an it instead of a thou. Okay? Now, that's just the intro, that's just a warm-up. And now if we look at quickly at chapter 1, and I've got just a single slide, actually. And it's a way to illustrate what the centerfold of the four-page document is all about. Again, my aim in writing this document, creating it, is to use only the Pope's words. So this is not my framework, my analysis, my assessment. But remarkably, the Pope gives us his own cliff notes, if you will. Cliff notes, that's a kind of, you know, a quick access I used to have when I was in college back in the Middle Ages. You know, if you were assigned to read Jane Eyre and you were running out of time, you might, you know, pick up a cliff notes booklet. Sparks now, I guess, is the preferred online access that today's undergraduates go to. But anyway, the Pope himself says, besides the chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sequence, which you might use to delve into this document, hey, here are 10 themes, recurring themes. Major themes that I care about as Pope that you're going to see time and again throughout this document. And so what I've done in the centerfold is to highlight in bold, in the Pope's very own words, what those 10 themes are. So what I said yesterday and what I would say again, it's an invitation for you to bring your own passions, your own convictions about the necessity to care for the earth and see if they match up with any of the Pope's major themes. And if they do, hey, begin there. Use that as a door, a window, if you will, into this document. Obviously, we're not going to master this document. We're not going to cover it. Rather, I see my task as one of romancing the student, as E.O. Wilson, father of sociobiology, once said to a group of educators. That's our job, to pique your interest, your curiosity, and perhaps your desire to delve into this in more depth. So a primary theme that cross-cuts many of the chapters is the one I'm showing on the screen. It's at the top on page 2 of your centerfold, the intimate relationship between the poor and the fragility of the planet. Another way of saying that is that this Pope speaks with equal conviction about the necessity of caring for the earth and the poor. That his understanding is inseparability of those two needs, those two dynamics of our common home. Notice he doesn't use the subtitle, our common environment. He doesn't use the term nature. He doesn't even use the term creation. He talks about our home and the multiple dimensions for us to understand and receive that term, that concept. So again, he writes, and this is from chapter 1, in a subsection under, hey, what's happening to our planet? This is a section not on nature, per se, but on the economic or the human dimension of caring for our home, speaking about the growing inequality global-wide between the haves and have-nots. And so he writes, the human environment and the natural environment deteriorate together. We cannot adequately combat environmental degradation unless we attend to causes related to human and social degradation. In fact, the deterioration of the environment and of society affects the most vulnerable people on the planet. So again, that is that is a drumbeat, you might say, that resonates and reverberates throughout this document. So, moving on to chapter 2, the Pope opens with this rhetorical question. Hey, if this letter, this encyclical, is addressed to all people of goodwill, people of professed faith, and those who do not profess, what is it doing in such a letter? Why should this document, he writes, include a chapter dealing with the convictions of believers? Now, before he outlines six different answers to his rhetorical question, he has a couple of things to say. Number one, he wants to say that no form of wisdom can be left out. So he is not seeking to speak exclusively and to shut out or marginalize other voices, other religions, the voice of science, and so on. This is one of his many ways of modeling dialogue, which he makes a commitment to at the very beginning of this document. But then he goes on to say, hey, even, you know, we're wide open, let's talk, but faith convictions can offer Christians and some other believers as well ample motivation to care for nature. So he's saying Christianity has something to bring to the table, something to bring to the conversation. And then, this is not a credit course, so I really couldn't insist on homework for a grade, but what I offered yesterday as a way to delve into that more is to pick one of the following subsections in this chapter and to see where it leads and to see if you found that particular subsection convincing. Because this is the Pope, it's sort of on the witness stand, you know, giving testimony to back up his assertion. Did anybody take me up on that? And if you did, care to share anything about that? Well, I'm not taking names, so you're off the hook. But what I thought might be interesting and useful is at this point to do a word search, or to show you how to do a word search with this document. Actually, maybe I'll just describe it. It, by the way, on my thumb drive, which you're welcome to use. I've got a copy of the full 80-page document. There's a wonderful word search thing you could do, and what I've done is to plug in the word hope. One of the, well, that's a central theme for Thursday, but all the way through. Is it all gloom and doom? The Pope, throughout even this chapter, uses that word again and again. So I won't take time now to ground that, but we'll move on. And then chapter 3, which we gave only a short shrift to, I think, yesterday. I've got a couple of more things to offer for our consideration. But the Pope here is using as a theme the human roots of the ecological crisis. What are the root causes? What is his take on that? And as we showed yesterday, there are a number of other authors that have suggest what they think are the underlying causes. Naomi Klein, for example, came out in 2014 with "This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate." How many have read that book or have heard about it? Yeah, she's pretty hard-headed and is offering a comprehensive critique of the dominant models and conceptual frameworks, sometimes called neoliberal economics, in that volume. And, of course, the Pope is saying in chapter 2, hey, let's talk, let's have dialogue, and so that is certainly one of the resources we can use. But in chapter 3, which begins with a recognition of the benefits, the many benefits of technology, but he is going to zero in on technology, but he is no Luddite, he's no breaker of machinery, he's not anti-technological. What he is critiquing, what he is deeply concerned about, is what he calls the one-dimensional, the undifferentiated, and one-dimensional technocratic paradigm. One way to say that in plain English, it is the exclusive use of technological thinking or technocratic thinking. Back to paragraph 11, it's basically thinking that that is based upon objectification. It's one in which we put, if we're mining resources, for example, we treat the resources of the earth exclusively as in an instrumental way, as something that is exclusively for human use and so on. And his language, let me now invite you to look at the centerfold. And it's theme number C. Maybe somebody could read that for it. It's just a paragraph where he puts this into more plain English. Someone care to read that? David, yeah, thank you.
The technological paradigm has become so dominant that it would be difficult to do without its resources, and even more difficult to utilize them without being dominated by their internal logic. Technology tends to absorb everything into its ironclad logic, and those who are surrounded with technology know full well that it moves forward in the final analysis neither for profit nor for the well-being of the human race. That in the most radical sense of the term, power is its motive, a lordship over all.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that. And that's about where we ran out of time yesterday. And I've got three more slides to offer here in this chapter, since it really is the heart of the Pope's a critique of the underlying causes for this ecological crisis. And he presses on in chapter 3 with a section on excessive anthropomorphism. So he calls it the crisis and effects of modern anthropomorphism, which is the excessive emphasis on on us as humans, creatures, and so on. Anthropos, man, in Greek. So, let's listen as I read this to get our minds around it. Modernity has been marked by an excessive anthropomorphism, an inadequate presentation of Christian anthropology, he says, gave rise to a wrong understanding of the relationship between human beings and the world. Often, what was handed on was a Promethean vision of mastery over the world. Remember the Greek god who stole fire from the gods, which gave the impression that the protection of nature was something that only the faint-hearted cared about. Now, I think what is important here in these next two slides is that there are some voices out there, strong voices, who take a very different approach than the Pope has taken. Let me underscore just a few words again from the encyclical. He calls it an inadequate presentation of Christian anthropology. In other words, the church hasn't done a very good job of describing what an authentic anthropology of humankind would look at. But here's another view. I don't know how many of you might have heard of Lynn White, a historian in the University of California system, UCLA. A little over 50 years, White's critique of the historical roots of our ecologic crisis appeared in the prestigious journal Science. If you have your table of contents handy and you look at the title of Lynn White's paper in Science, it's only 5 pages long, very brief. And yet it is one of the most cited articles since then. It's 50 years old. Time and again, it's an indispensable conversation partner, you might say, for anybody in the field who is writing about care for the earth. And so the Pope chose to title chapter 3, if you're looking at your centerfold, The Human Roots of the Ecological Crisis. And is it just a coincidence, just happenstance, that Lynn White's title is The Historic Roots of our Ecologic, he doesn't say ecological, but he says ecologic crisis. I'll go out on a limb and kind of venture that the Pope is really, Lynn White is very much on his mind, and of course the other people in the Vatican and other scientists and so on that I think arguably helped the Pope write this document. But to me, there's a remarkable similarity here between the titles of chapter 3 and what Professor White has to say. Well, let's look at just a couple of sentences, well, more than a sentence, but really just to see where Lynn White is coming from. What we do about ecology, Lynn White says, depends on our ideas of the man-nature relationship. More science and more technology are not going to get us out of the present ecologic crisis until we find a new religion or rethink our old one. Well, that itself is pretty remarkable, I think. He goes on to say, no new set of basic values has been accepted in our society to displace those of Christianity. Again, he's speaking as an historian here. Hence, we shall continue to have a worsening ecologic crisis until we reject the Christian axiom that nature has no reason for existence save to serve man. Mankind, we would say now, or humankind, but this is written 50 years ago, okay? A feminist sensitivity hadn't quite reached UCLA, or at least some of the faculty back then. So he's taking direct aim and putting the finger on Christianity. He's not saying like the Pope, there's not a problem. There's just been some inadequate interpretation of what a Christian anthropology has to say. Now, I'm not here to say who's right and so on, but to say there is a legitimate dialogue of people who are respectfully, I hope, disagree with each other. Let's go on to look at something that is even more remarkable, at least to my ears, my eyes. He refers to St. Francis in this journal article appearing in Science, the greatest spiritual revolutionary in Western history, Lynn White says, St. Francis, tried to substitute the idea of the equality of all creatures, including man, for the idea of man's limitless rule of creation. He failed. Both our present science and our present technology are so tinctured with orthodox Christian arrogance toward nature that no solution for our ecologic crisis can be expected from them alone. And then, since the roots of our trouble are so largely religious, the remedy must also be essentially religious. Whether we call it that or not, I propose Francis as a patron saint for ecologists. So that is a view that appears again and again in the literature. Pope Francis is not the only one to respond to Lynn White. There are other voices. Wendell Berry is a voice that some of you may know. And in a book of essays, I believe called The Good Earth, he takes on a Professor White. So if that's a trail that you want to follow some more, I recommend Wendell Berry's response. And of course, Lynn White lifts up the Genesis 1, verse 26, 27, domination, dominion, and so on. Just as a brief aside, what Wendell Berry does is to go on and look at the rest of the canon, the Old Testament canon, and the injunction to care for the earth, to keep it, and so on. So fascinating to see these two great minds, Lynn White and Wendell Berry, going at it hammer and tongs in these essays and so on. So, all right, well, now you're all caught up. You weren't here yesterday, okay. Let me pause there, and because I've been going here one way, we won't do that through the whole rest of our time. But remarks, comments, questions? David?
Yeah, another question about the Pope's approach. I mean, pretty clearly he doesn't talk about rejecting Christianity, but I think he's talking about understanding the full picture without the misplaced Pope. And in that sense, he's endorsing Lynn White's position, but without a solution.
Reactions? Remarks? What do the rest of you think?
Well, I'm
these guys at loggerheads, or are they? Is there some common ground? Yeah.
Well, I'm just surprised. Sort of in this day and age, that the fingers would be pointed at Christians to solve or not solve or cause or, I mean, it just doesn't, in this technological age, we seem to be a minor voice, and I'm surprised the solution, or, I don't know, I'm just surprised that we are central to the conversation.
I hear what you're saying, and it is a valid comment. But in the body of the essay, the paper, White is speaking as an historian and arguing that how do I say it, not, the origin, for example, of many of our laws comes from the Judaic Christian heritage. That would be one example. And he's arguing that, that the ethos of Christianity, not necessarily its doctrines, its concepts, and of course, it's been pointed out by many historians and ethicists that the doctrine or the core belief that the earth is good and that we are endowed by reason, some have taken, you know, the combination of those two rather obvious statements to say that Christianity has been responsible then, or it has been one of the root causes for the development of modern science and so on. So he, he's really taking that kind of a cultural understanding, we might say, of Christianity, rather than, say, specific doctrines about belief, salvation, and so on. Does that help a little?
Yeah.
By the way, I have a copy of that on my traveling bag too. Oh, there's lots of space on that little drum, and I've also got the canticles, which are from YouTube. So if you want the one I showed yesterday, which is really powerful with the entire canticle from 800 years ago set to music with the imagery, it's there. So yeah, just ask me. Okay, so other comments on what reviewed so far?
I was aware, just maybe only a few years ago, that the kind of disagreements that are between the environmentalists and the Christian fundamentalists, who interpret that domination as we can use all these objects. We have the right to do that, and you're interfering with our rights. So I can see the point about the definition of words from scripture. All that kind of dominating.
I have lived long enough to recall the words of James Watt, I think, Secretary of Interior under Reagan, who basically argued that there, this may be unfair here to former Secretary Watt, but that we really don't have to work very hard to take care of the environment because the rapture is on its way and so on. Now, if we have time this afternoon, I'm gonna, I have a 90-second clip from a climate scientist who is an evangelical Christian. And we will hear more from her tomorrow. Catherine Hayhoe is her name. Anybody hear of Catherine Hayhoe? Yeah, okay, some voices up there. I had some hands from up there. Yes, Time Magazine recently recognized her as one of the most the 100 most influential people in the world, on the basis of looking at the number, the estimate of 80 million evangelical Christians in the U.S., most of whom reject that human activity has anything to do with climate change, greenhouse gases, and so on. So, and since we're going to be talking about hope tomorrow, I mean, we want to have some tangible examples. We're not just going to do theory and castles in the air about hope, but show me some examples. But I think she's one. There's a wonderful interview with Bill Moyers that's longer than we have time for, 25 minutes. Again, available on YouTube. Hey, that's on my jump shot. But we'll look at some shorter things. But she is a bright spot. Somebody who knows the science, affirms the science, argues that we have been gifted by God with reason and also the obligation to care for the planet. If you were here earlier today, our son's discussion about stewardship comes to mind, and Douglas John Hall's extraordinary treatment of stewardship rings with that. Yeah. So yes, sir.
There's another voice that for me has seen deeper into the situation, and that's of Thomas Berry, who's a historian, the looking into the Christian roots with take Lynn White's title. And Thomas Berry attributes it to the millennial view that is presented in the Book of Revelation. And he dates it from the plagues during the Middle Ages that devastated Europe, wiping out a significant portion of the population. I don't remember numbers of
fourth to a third, yeah.
Something like that. And the attitude that developed is that God was punishing humans. And that the need is for a salvation out of the world. That the world is, the earth is somehow fundamentally a problem. And this attitude has been picked up among American evangelicals in particular, looking at the Book of Revelation that makes the promise of, actually I'm not all that familiar with the text, that the return of the second coming of Christ and a period of 1,000 years of the millennium of perfect happiness, the end of all death and suffering, that in this view, the earth will be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And the words of the Book of Revelation is that I see a new heavens and a new earth coming. This language, this text, has been interpreted literally by many of the evangelical voices within the American culture. And to me, this is a much more profound explanation of the Christian contribution to the environmental crisis than Lynn White's criticism. The antidote, or the words of Thomas Berry, his teaching goes back to St. Francis, who developed the idea of incarnation. What does it mean for the divine to take on flesh? That for St. Francis, incarnation is not only the birth of Jesus, but it's actually the creation of the entire cosmos. He maintains that the universe is, from the beginning, both a material and a spiritual phenomenon. That God is, the divine is present in all things. This is the deeper meaning of incarnation. And coming back to St. Francis, finding the presence of the divine in all things, our relationships with all created beings, the brother and sister, these family relationships, is for Thomas Berry key to the way forward. The video presented this morning about nature does not need humans. Humans need nature. And the question asked is, are we ready to evolve? And to me, that is, that's key. That the process of evolution taking place in the material world has brought forth humans with our own capability, our own giftedness, and much the analysis of Laudato Si is seeing ourselves as separate from creation, somehow over and above creation, not and failing to see ourselves as part of creation, as integral, and really to learn how that evolutionary process is occurring and how we participate.
May I use that word integral as a segue into chapter 4? Yeah, thank you so much for that. Thomas Berry's work, book, The Great Work, comes to mind, which I heartily recommend. As you say, another voice, not just about the past, or not just about the causes of our current situation, but how do we move forward? The Great Work. So, if I may, nudge us toward the second half of the encyclical, and we're not going to slog our way through with equal depth through all of the sections. In fact, it's really chapter 4 that I want to hunker down with. Yes, Dave.
To go back just a little bit, the translation of the message treats this business about dominion, I think, rather well. Reflecting God's nature, He created them male and female. God blessed them. Prosper, reproduce, fill her, take charge, be responsible for fish and the sea, the birds of the air, for every living thing on the face of the earth. That's a challenge, an assignment which says, be my agents.
Spiritual.
Steward.
Mm-hmm. Stewards, as we could say, agents, a perfectly good word, yeah. Thank you for lifting that up. Okay, let's awaken my laptop here once again. And while I'm doing that, look on the right half, the right column on the cover, which has got the outline of the document, chapters 1 through 6. And we're going to take a look at 4, 5, and 6, although not with equal emphasis. In fact, I'm really going to talk about 6, or bring 6 into the conversation tomorrow. And I'm going to give some quick recaps of chapter 5. It's really chapter 4, this, I think, novel understanding of the Pope's contribution here. So, chapter 4, in just a few words, or the rest of this document, in a few words, chapter 4 is going to talk about the human meaning of ecology. Again, think back to what Francis says in the intro and his conviction, his insistence that we give equal weight to the environment understood in terms of nature and of humankind, the inseparability of the destiny, if you will, of both. Chapter 5, he's going to lay out lines of approach and action. And if you look at the subcategories under chapter 5, quickly, what word do you see again and again and again?
Dialogue.
Going back to his commitment in paragraph 3. Let's have a dialogue. Let's talk. So this is not meant to be one way. And then chapter 6. Ecological education and spirituality. And these are my words. Equipping ourselves for the task at hand. The way I see chapter 5 and chapter 6 is chapter 5 is going to chart the exterior conversation. You might say the exterior path. He's going to talk about the need for, you know, greater global cooperation. He's going to be talking about the need at local and national levels for action and so on. But in 6, he's going to speak to the depth, dimension, in a personal way for us. Again, the question I began with, one of the questions, how do we participate in this challenge, these tasks, without ourselves adding to the anxiety, the fear, the anger even? How do we remain faithful? Not out of duty, drudgery, you know. And if you think back to the face of the Pope at the beginning, I mean, there's a guy who's really got a swamp to drain. Does he not? Yeah. And yet he exudes this spirit. In fact, when he first became Pope, his first, not he, in the encyclical, but I believe it's called an apostolic exhortation, Evangelii, forgive me, I studied German, Latin, or Italian, but it's like the joy of the gospel is what he wrote about. And then, so there he is, writing to the faithful. And just to take a peek ahead, his document, this encyclical, ends with a song. He says, let us sing as we go forth with our concerns, our struggles, and our concern about the future of the planet, so as not to lose the joy of our hope. So, what? Isn't the Pope reading the newspapers these days? Doesn't he know about the calving of the iceberg and the Larsen Sea Shelf and the Antarctic in July? It's not, you know, does he know about, you know, the current administration's public decision to try to get us out of the Paris Agreement? And on and on and on. So we're gonna spend some quality time on that tomorrow, as well as in bringing in other voices that also speak to this notion of hope. Something Emily Dickinson, I believe, talks about it as that thing with feathers that perches on the soul. And we'll bring in some other poetic expressions about hope too. So, anyway, moving on. And now you can, again, use your centerfold to advantage and take a look at the four quotes at the top right. They all have to do with the human meaning of ecology. Again, we see how he's taking this environmental term, a term that really has been, I think, somewhat limited to fields like environmental science, biology, and so on. And I'll just read, just the light's kind of dim here, the reading. Since everything is closely interrelated, I suggest we now consider some elements of an integral ecology, one that clearly respects its human and social dimensions. So again, he's making space for the human and social dimensions on equal terms, we might say. And again, if this word integral is one that you that gives you pause, you could think of not only holistic, but integrable, if that's a word. In other words, the intertwining of those two dimensions. So it's not, you've got the environment over here, and over here you've got human and social. He's really all about the indissoluble intermediates of those two. Maybe I'm belaboring the obvious, but doesn't hurt, I don't think, to say it now and then. So then, next paragraph, what do these foundational terms mean, anyway? So he defines ecology as that branch of knowledge, we could say, that studies the relationships between living organisms and the environment in which they develop. It cannot be emphasized enough how everything is interconnected. And I'm going to not go on to talk about the common good yet. I'm going to dive, do a little deeper dive into what I've just read. interesting. Here again, we'll see the inseparability of these two dimensions. We are faced not with two separate crises, the Pope says, one environmental and the other social, but rather with one complex crisis, which is both social and environmental. Strategies for a solution demand an integrated approach to combating poverty, restoring dignity to the excluded, and at the same time protecting nature. Now, back to your cover, if you will, for just a minute. Look at with me at the outline under chapter 4, integral ecology, and he's going to begin to break this down into bite-sized pieces. And section 1, environmental, economic, and social ecology. Now, if you've had any experience in, say, reading about sustainable development, you might, those terms will be familiar, I would argue, that the World Bank and the WTO, of all places, the World Trade Organization, has engaged the notion of sustainable development, and argues that it has these three dimensions, okay? So this is really pretty standard stuff, even if you're working for the World Trade Organization. Somebody reading this document, reading this section would say, yeah, right on, you know, environment, economic, and social, great, what's next? Well, the Pope adds two other dimensions to integral ecology. Cultural ecology and the ecology of daily life, terms I've never heard before. That may just be my own shallow reading and not reading enough, but and we will come back to these new or unusual dimensions of in integral ecology in just a minute. But I want to pause here and bore into the Pope's mention of an economic ecology. And I didn't give you any background at the beginning, I apologize for that, but as an adjunct faculty member at the University of Denver, I taught a course in the spring last year called Ecological Economics and Human Well-Being, in which we examined the challenge of whether or not we can measure and monetize the value of ecosystem services, and philosophically, ethically, whether we ought to even try to apply measures and monetary units to do so. And I'd love to have that conversation with any of you interested after the class. So, what does the Pope say about this strange combination of words, you might say? Economic growth, for its part, tends to produce predictable reactions and a certain standardization with the aim of simplifying procedures and reducing costs, he writes. This suggests the need for a, quote, economic ecology capable of appealing to a broader vision of reality. We urgently need a humanism capable of bringing together the different fields, including economics, in the service of a more integral and integrating vision. Integrating, that was the word I was looking for just a minute ago. Now, I thought it would be interesting to share at least one attempt to develop something along the lines that the Pope has in mind. And what you see here on the right is the cover of the text that I used in my course in 2016. It's co-authored by Herman Daly and a young ecological economist, Joshua Farley, F-A-R-L-E-Y. And, pardon? Oh, question? Okay. My aim here is not to dive into the book, but just to so much, but to get Herman Daly's name out. Are you, how many, for how many here is that a somewhat familiar name, Herman Daly? Okay, you, all right. Yeah, just a little background about Daly. One-time senior economist with the World Bank, where he helped to develop guidelines for sustainable development. He actually left after 6 years because he was so dissatisfied with the conceptual framework that the World Bank was using to approach sustainable development. He's a proponent of a steady state economy. I have a copy of his book by that title that he wrote in 1973 on my shelf from the DU library. He's also a recipient of several international awards in the area of environment. Most recently, he was one of the recipients of the Blue Planet Award in Tokyo. It's awarded by a Japanese glass company, I believe they underwrite this. And I'm going to draw on some pieces of his acceptance speech in just a minute. So Daly is sharing a little reminiscence here about his time at the World Bank that I want to use as a motivating question. So why does any of this matter anyway? Well, when I worked at the World Bank, Daly says, I often heard the statement, there is no conflict between economics and ecology. We can and must grow the economy and protect the environment at the same time. And again, this is directly from his speech at the Blue Planet Award ceremony. I still hear that a lot today. Is it true? Is it possible? Well, Daly, in an article that first caught my eye in the Scientific American, I believe it was in 2005 or 2006, I don't have a copy of that on that thumb drive, but I've got a copy on my master thumb drive if you're interested. It's an 8-page article. I used to assign it to students. Here's an example of Daly's contention that we now live in a full world, and that he offers as a paradigm shift, moving from an empty world, a once empty world, to today a full world. And this is one of his down-home or homely examples. Okay? And this is directly in the printed copy of his speech. And I do have a copy of his entire speech on my thumb drive. So on the left, lots of fish, just a few boats, just a few fishermen. That's the empty world situation. Today, lots of boats, lots of fish, and I'm sure we could go into detail on that. You know, trawlers that are vacuuming up, you know, fisheries, and the plight of world fisheries is well known. Lots of man-made capital, not much natural capital. And so in ecological economics terms, we could look at the empty world as a world in which natural capital, ecosystem services, we could call it, plentiful, and population was a tenth, perhaps, of what it is today. And now it's just the inverse, or the reverse. Full world, we have lots of man-made capital, lots of technology, and so on. And I couldn't resist quoting some more examples from Daly's speech. What limits the production of cut timber? Is it the number of chainsaws, sawmills, and lumberjacks? Or the remaining forests and the growth rate of new trees? What limits the crops from irrigated agriculture? Is it the number of pipes, sprinklers, and pumps? Or the stock of water in aquifers, like the Ogallala Aquifer that touches part of Colorado? I was manager for the Colorado piece of an 8-state study back in the late 70s. Is it the or is it the number of pipes, sprinklers, and pumps, or the stock of water in aquifers, the recharge rate, and the flow of surface water in rivers? The recharge rate of the Ogallala Aquifer that touches parts of eight states, as I mentioned, is about 1%, if that. And so we are basically mining the Ogallala. Yeah. So, in other words, to say it in a sentence from Daly, the limiting factor is no longer man-made capital, but natural capital. And here's, they say a picture is worth a thousand words. Here's some pictures from that, the written copy of his presentation. This is his picture of the economy within Earth's ecosystem. If you were here for the morning presentation, you might recall David's model of the economy as a bullseye, and then the next ring, society, and then the ecosphere is the larger context, the largest circle. Just another way that he used to, again, put the economic dimension within the ecological. And the point here is that the brown box representing the economy is tiny relative to the ecosystems, we could say plural or singular, but we're talking about the globe as a whole. And you see various arrows showing recycling and welfare and so on. If you look at those kind of fuzzy arrows, the one at the bottom going to welfare, and then there's a skinny line coming from the brown box to welfare. I've actually got a pointer here, maybe, but I won't take the time to get it. So you can see that the ecosystem services in an empty world, lots of welfare benefits. Welfare in the sense of adding to the well-being of humankind. And in contrast, this is what the picture looks like, according to Daly, in a full world. And so now back to his question, you see, can we have our cake and eat it too? Can we have growth and environmental protection? And what he says, in effect, in his paper, at once upon a time, that was possible. When our population was a tenth or a fifth of what it is today, over 7 billion, on our way to 8 billion, adding 80 million people a year to the planet, yeah, we could have both. That is, we could have growth and environmental protection, or at least at rates where at which depletion rates were sustainable, manageable. Whoops. But not so in our day, he argues. Yeah, and there they are together. Okay. Now, I'm going to move on from there. Let me invite some feedback, you know, comments, questions. We've got about 15 minutes. Is that a helpful paradigm, a way to understand where we are in simple terms, empty world to the whole world?
Was he saying that we can't have economic growth because we have limited resources now? We can't have both? Is that what he was trying to say?
Yeah, more precisely, he would say we have to choose, we have a trade-off. Yeah, if we want to continue to accelerate the development of man-made capital, it will be at the expense of ecosystem services. If you were here yesterday, you saw the 7 points in the National Geographic article, 7 things we all ought to know about climate change, and you know the sea levels are rising, wildlife are stressed, one of the ways that that was described, and so on. Yeah, This is just Daley's way. He's a diagram, you know, economist kind of guy, but they're really saying the same thing, I think, in a couple of different ways. Yeah, he's actually challenging, you see, that paradigm, that narrative, almost a mantra. And in another fundamental part of the dominant narrative, the conventional paradigm, well, we see it in the paper every day, you know, the debate in Congress over the president is pushing for, you know, 3% growth or 4% growth, and as he was during the campaign, and others are saying, well, maybe 1% growth, 2%. Daley is saying, we should be thinking in terms of development, not growth. Where development, he says, and eloquently discusses it in his paper, is the qualitative improvement of well-being for both nature and humankind. It's moving beyond the mindless assertion that more is better. Yeah. And that only things or affluenza can make us happy. Yeah. So, just...
Well, I mean, I think going back to the discussion we had earlier about the Christian role in this, churches that would preach, my feeling would be that churches that preach a prosperity gospel are feeding right into this, because there it is more is better, and if more is better and the more I have, the more is God's blessing me, then I'm going to have a real hard time saying I should be doing something for the common good, because that's not receiving what God wants from me.
Yeah,
yeah, reminds me of, you know, some people read Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand as a justification for selfishness is good.
Oh,
Ayn Rand, you know, a philosopher that Paul Ryan, among others, venerates has fostered such a perspective.
Well, the problem.
Yeah, go ahead and then Wolfgang. Yeah.
In relation to Adam Smith, having read his initial book, you know, on the Wealth of Nations, the Inquiry and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, which he wrote in 1776, he pointed out every man seeking his own set of interests will necessarily lead to the best benefit for all. What they don't tell you is providing. He had conditions in there. There's perfect competition. There are many sellers and buyers, none which are strong enough to influence price. Providing there is perfect knowledge. Everybody knows exactly what you're getting into. And providing there is a social framework which stamps successes and looks into the distribution. Because that concept of the invisible hand works quite well in production, but not in distribution, who gets the product and who gets the output. It's a matter of winner take all. And that's part of the reason we have so much emphasis on it.
Thank
the
you
one
so
that
much.
Costs something, the distribution aspect, you may have to give something up, or to have regulation to curtail some of those things, to require that in effect you know when you sign a contract or you borrow money what you're actually paying back, say. That is usually fought against because that means they can make less money if you know it. You wouldn't that's why they cash in. That is really the big problems with it, by following that model. And that's all me, myself, and I, and the hell with anybody else. That's all the theory teaches.
Well, chapter 4 is pretty, thank you. That was very helpful. To delve into that more, Smith's the theory of moral sentiments also comes to mind that is part of that larger context that Wolfgang is pointing to. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you can't have economic growth. What you really want to do is you want to increase your output. If you can increase your output with less input, or no negative side effects, and then you distribute it properly, then everybody can be better off. So it is possible. It doesn't automatically mean that, you know, if you grow more, that is necessarily bad. Because you look at countries who have a very poor standard of living. Just look at their sanitation aspects. Because they spend all their time just barely feed themselves and get enough to eat for the family. They don't have time to clean up things or keep things safe and so forth. So you need a certain level of productivity and a certain level of means and output in order to do all those other nice things, you know, to get people educated. That the ones who are working are that productive that a relatively large number of people don't have to work. Like, you know, 300-400 years ago, every kid had to work to just feed the family. Then the productivity was very low. Now, you know, one person can work and feed the rest of the family. So the rest of them can develop and do something else. See, those, there are so many, it's much more complicated with that. It's a matter of how it's done and how smart it is. And what is the net overall sum?
May I take your comments on distribution?
The distribution is the problem.
One other way to discuss Daly's orientation is that he is not anti-market, nor is the Pope, by the way.
No.
The Pope, mm-hmm. just like technology, takes time to acknowledge the importance of markets. But what Daly and the Pope both do, let's say, is to embed market dynamics and the role of the markets within a larger ethical system, we could say, one in which the stability of the Earth's ecosystems is paramount, along with equitable distribution of the Earth's resources. And this is a position that Daly describes in detail with eco-theologian John Codd in a book that really motivated me to go back to school at my advanced age after a career in the Department of Agriculture for the common good. Right. And I'm mindful of our time. We have about 5 minutes. And I do want to whet your appetite about hope and before we leave, if I may. And I'm happy to stay around and later and or afterward and go from there. But I think you're in for a treat, okay? At least I see it that way. If I can figure out how to close this. There we go. Let's see. Let me get back to my... Thank you. Yeah. All right. This is a 90-second elevator speech by an evangelical Christian who is a climate scientist, Catherine Hayhoe of Lubbock, Texas.
What would be your elevator pitch to explain climate change? You step in an elevator and someone asks.
I've got to get that up there.
Are you a climate scientist? What's going on with climate change?
I wouldn't start with the science. So often we're told to say with the science, it's real, it's us, it's bad, but there are solutions. So that's the science message. But I don't think we can start right away with the science. I think we have to start with the values. So I would start with saying, I care about X, whatever I have in common with the person I'm talking to. Even if, you know, say it's somebody from West Texas. I care about Texas and I care about our future. We don't have a future with water. Climate change will make that water more scarce. We know climate is changing here and around the world. We know humans are responsible. We know it's going to affect our water resources, but here are all the great things that we're already doing and that we can do even more in Texas to benefit ourselves and to give ourselves a more secure future.
Okay, comments, takeaways. How about from someone that hasn't had a chance yet to use the public airspace? What are you going to take from this? What? You didn't go hiking today? You went to the 90-minute session? Any takeaways?
It's good to be reminded that we start with common ground. And we're discussing this with people that might have a different opinion. And to go from there. I'm glad for that moment. And the values, she said, are there are common values.
Thank you. Anyone else?
It's like trying to take a bite out of an elephant. Where do you start?
One bite at a time.
But it's the elephant that just...
No. One bite at a time. You can make a difference.
Yes, Dave?
I did some world food studies some time ago. And it was an interesting thing. The figure that I played with was the productivity of agriculture, just in broadly spoken. And I tried reducing it by 20% and increasing it by 20%. And what I found, based on the construct of it, was the population responded to that. And the final conclusion was that we as a society, globally, have a certain tolerance towards starvation. And when I increase it by 20% or 30%, population grew till we reached that level of starvation. When I reduced it by 20% or 25%, population shrunk to the same level of starvation. And so we are dealing with a social paradigm which says that we're comfortable with a certain number of street people, certain misapplication, misdistribution of food and of care, medical care, but that it is a deficiency, I think, in the human race.
Okay. And with that, I thank you very much. Whoa, food for thought. Thank you all for coming.
So that was the home message.
Yeah, tomorrow I have 11, and not 2:35. Back to our usual time, yeah.